Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Catharsis. A purification or purgation that brings about spiritual renewal or release from tension. That is how Merriam-Webster defines the word. It also says the elimination of a complex by bringing it to consciousness and affording it expression. It's hard to imagine a better word to describe these past few weeks. After months of fear and mourning amid a global pandemic, we are now in the streets trying to eliminate the complex of racism by bringing it to consciousness. God knows what comes next, whether all of this purgation, all of this new consciousness, will take us to a truly new place as a society. But personally, I think I'm finally able to see past all the pain to something more hopeful. One of my old friends, a tough, smart woman who's been present for a lot of protest and uprising, she captured my emotions in a group email recently. She wrote, "It's a horrifying but beautiful, beautiful moment." So in this episode, we pause to think about release and renewal. We have two conversations in which people share their own cathartic journeys through this horrifying, beautiful time. I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future. Hey, Verlin.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Our producer, Verlin Williams, recently had her first sort of big break with social distancing when she went out to a protest in Harlem.
Yes. Since the latest slew of Black people being killed at the hands of the police, I felt very much compelled to go out there.
And you and millions of other people.
Yeah, but, you know, but also, like, I think, like, as a journalist, a part of what I feel called to do is to bear witness, right? So I just felt like if my people are out there, you know, quote unquote people are out there, I felt like I needed to be out there amplifying their voice. And I got there, I was not 6 feet from everyone, and that put me in my feelings a little bit. But then I heard this woman who like climbed on the ladder and talked into a megaphone, and her voice just had so much passion in it.
And as a Black woman who's raising beautiful Black boys,
come on. Yes.
I am often gripped with fear that this unjust society will seek to snuff out the life that God put in them.
And it was the moment where I realized that, like, oh, this is exactly where I needed to be. Mm. Like, it was like something that was in me that needed to break free was set loose.
Mm. A release.
A release, for sure.
So my name is Shanika Hart.
I'm sure you're not surprised, but I called her up.
You can identify me as a disciple of Christ.
She's a wife. She's a mom.
I'm a sister. I'm a friend.
She's a social worker.
More specifically, I'm a family therapist.
And she's the first lady of the Gathering Harlem, which is the church that organized the protest.
I wear many, many hats.
And what'd you guys talk about when you reached out to her?
Well, we talked about the thing that really struck me, which was the way she was able to so directly speaks to the grief that she and so many Black women carry. you know, I was really taken by just how emotional you were describing your fears around being a Black mother.
I mean, so the fears that I have around being a Black mom is oftentimes consists of the conversations that I'll have to have with my sons. My son Jeremiah told me the other day, you know, mommy, the police, they only lock up bad people, right, mommy? And that broke my heart because while I said yes, I know that I'm also going to be having, I have to have another conversation with him as he grows up and as his brain is able to understand that sometimes just being Black is enough to be wrong in America.
Mm. How old is he?
He's 3 years old. He's four. He just turned four not too long ago. And so, yeah, the fear is that they are ridiculously cute. They're ridiculously innocent, right? They're ridiculously compassionate and loving. And, you know, how we govern our home is how we govern our lives, right? And we are led by the fact that we are to honor everyone. We are to dignify everyone and love everyone. And my deepest, you know, fear, there's sadness around the fact that, you know, my sons might not receive the same as they navigate this world.
Mm. And what about yourself? Has the fear of violence touched your life as you navigate the world?
One evening, Kenneth and I, we were walking our dog. And it was one of those streets that has like an island. And so I was on the island and Kenneth was across the street and he's playing hide and seek with my dog. And I'm, you know, Zoe's pulling me, trying to find Kenneth. And while I'm walking with Zoe, all I hear is like, skirt. And then cops in an unmarked car, they jump out and they have Kenneth pressed up against a gate. And I'm walking with Zoe. I turn around and I'm like, oh, shoot. Something's going on over there. Walk a little bit closer. I realize that that's my husband pressed up against the gate. And they are screaming at him, put your hands up. What are you doing? Da, da, da. So come to find out, they thought Kenneth was breaking into a car because he was hiding for a brief second. But I mean, when I tell you, full in rage, I ran across the street like, what are you doing to my husband? And just to see how they were dealing with him, right? He did absolutely nothing wrong, but because he was Black, he was already suspicious. Mm-hmm. I had a deep fear for Kenneth's life. He could have made one wrong move and became another hashtag that night. But he also simultaneously had that same fear for me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's like, I'm all right, babe. Like, it's all right. Back up. You know, I'm not resisting, officer. Both of my hands up. Both of us fear-ridden for the same people who are supposed to protect us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's when a light bulb went off to me. Like, no, literally, just for being Black, there is no, oh, the people in the South. Like, this is happening up north. This is happening to all of us, chiefly because we have Black skin.
Mm-hmm. And so in response to the horrific death of George Floyd, your church organized the Justice, Love, Mercy protest?
Yeah. So our church, this is within the very DNA of TGH. What can we do to respond, right, to support, to mobilize our church to act? And Kenneth made a couple of calls. Next thing, he goes, you know, babe, I think this is happening. We have like a few churches in. And as the days were going, it was like, all right, two more churches are in. Oh, three more churches are in. I'm like, okay, Lord. I remember Kenneth and I coming around the corner and as we're approaching the crowd, you know, we have a few people like, yeah, people are already outside, you know, people are excited. And then going around the bend, you see floods of people in front of the National Black Theater, which is actually where we hold, we before the pandemic, we were holding services. In the back of my mind, I'm like, Lord, give me an utterance because, you know, I'm going to have to speak in front of these people, too. It was uncomfortable. It was, man, I have to speak in front of all these people. But then I realized that there are mothers who their discomfort doesn't go away. Right. And so everyone has a responsibility. Mine was to let my voice be heard.
That's George Floyd. Laid on the concrete with his life being suffocated from him. He cried out, Mama! Mama! And just demonstrated that the second most important thing to living was the comfort and the protection of his mother.
Yes.
You know, in thinking about the responsibility you all felt for mobilizing folks, but we're also in the midst of a pandemic, right? So, like, what were those conversations like?
So we also did not want it to be the case where people were, you know, they were showing up for this just cause, but then having to deal with COVID, which is also killing us, right? And so it was really important for us to make that clear for everyone who joined. And there were over 4,000 people present. And it was so good to see everyone taking on that personal responsibility for themselves and for their neighbor. Right. It really did demonstrate a sense of one accountability, but also a love. Like I love you. And so I'm going to consider you just by simply wearing a mask. And so I loved that we weren't completely paused because of COVID, but we can still exercise wisdom in the midst of it.
And so in the midst of all this, in the midst of everything you've described with, you know, holding the community within your own family, how are you doing? Like,
So for right now, because of the pandemic, an average day for me looks like, you know, I'm getting up in the morning. I am, you know, caring for my infant daughter, getting my boys ready for the day. Brushing teeth and getting breakfast all prepared before starting remote learning. And then I'm jumping into a day's work for me. But on a random night, you can find us blasting music, probably Maxwell, and just dancing, the whole family in our living room. Because we can fight for joy, right? Like, it's an act of resistance that we're not going to sit in the sorrows that oftentimes evades us. But yeah, and that those are such sweet moments for me.
Joy, rage, grief, they're all part of it, all part of this catharsis we're moving through together as a society. And they kind of work on each other, you know, like they're an inseparable tangle of emotions. And a lot of times they come out all at once. Which is why I don't think you can separate out the Black Lives Matter uprising, this huge cathartic outpouring we've seen. You can't separate that from the grim reality of the coronavirus pandemic. The sheer scale of loss, the total feeling of insecurity against this invisible deadly threat. I feel like maybe that forced something to the surface that can no longer be repressed. Here in New York, over 24,000 people have died from COVID-19. Over 100,000 have died nationally. an enormous number of us have had to mourn the loss of someone we love and do it under exceptionally difficult circumstances, when we're unable to gather close, to cook for each other, hug each other, all the stuff we would normally do to celebrate the end of a life. And so many, many people have had to find new rituals to release and to renew in the wake of death. That's next.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
On May 6th, Lloyd Porter lost his battle with COVID-19 at a hospital in New York City. He was 49 years old, just one of well over 100 people in the city who succumbed to the pandemic on just that day. But in life, Lloyd stood out. In the videos he posted on social media, you can hear he's playful and funny and loving.
Good morning, Hillary.
In 2004, he and his wife Hillary opened a cafe called Bread Stuy.
How's it on your first day of official business?
It wasn't far from their home in Bed-Stuy, or Bedford-Stuyvesant, which is a historically black neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Thumbs up!
I lived in Bed-Stuy around that time for a little over a decade. And while I didn't know Lloyd personally, I knew of him. Almost everybody did. Bed-Stuy, and later another cafe they owned called Bread Love, they were among a handful of these small black-owned businesses that were in many ways just the heartbeat of the neighborhood. The entrepreneurs who ran them created these spaces for a wide, eclectic, and mostly black community to come together. It was just this beautiful collection of black people from all different walks of life, and we'd gather in these businesses to work, to socialize, and to celebrate.
Happy New Year!
Lloyd was instrumental in bringing that world to life. And a lot of friends. People loved him.
You know how people talk about there's the mayor of the neighborhood or the mayor of a block? Lloyd was that and more. He was like the beating heart of Bed-Stuy.
Kathleen Horn is a reporter who's written a lot about death and mourning. It's been her beat for more than a decade. And so throughout this time of unprecedented loss, she's been writing obituaries, chronicling the lives of New Yorkers who didn't make it, including Lloyd's.
He completely created this special place where anyone could come and be themselves.
Right.
I mean, that was really important to him. And it was just the center of the neighborhood. So they would have barbecues and dance parties. They would have pumpkin carving contests and Shakespeare festivals.
There was chess tournaments or chess lessons for kids. There was Scrabble tournaments. There was going and cleaning up the playground together. There was just so much energy and community built in that space.
Many of his friends started as customers, and Mandisa Turner is one of those people.
Anybody who was in Bed-Stuy in the Bed-Stuy era has fond memories of it.
Right on, Mac, you know how we do.
Lloyd was like the, his wife, Hillary, is a pastry chef. And Lloyd was the personality.
Hanging out, cruising Chester.
There was always something engaging and fun to do.
It sounds so joyous to me.
Yeah, you know, Lloyd was a great connector. So if you were working on something and he knew someone that could help you, he would introduce you. His voice,
and he made me a coffee that really put my own cream in it,
was just very booming and jovial and happy.
Grandmama, grandmama on Mother's Day.
And he always remembered people. So you didn't have to come in there more than once. And, you know, if he had the opportunity to engage with you, he was going to try his best to remember something about you.
Here we are on Travis's birthday. Happy birthday, Travis.
Happy birthday!
Where was Lloyd Porter from? Where did he grow up?
He's originally from Bakersfield, California, just north of L.A. He's one of eight kids.
Kathleen.
Gregory. You know, I spoke with his brother, Gregory Porter.
Nice to meet you. I'm sorry it's for a terrible reason.
Yes, understand.
He's a Grammy Award-winning singer who also lives in California.
Lloyd was my running partner. Because we were so close in age, we did everything together.
He's your big brother, right? Where are you both in the eight kids?
He's sixth and I'm seventh, and he is a year and a half older than me.
And Gregory told me this story about what it was like growing up in Bakersfield and why he and Lloyd had this very deep and lasting bond with each other.
This was when we were 7, 8, 9, and Bakersfield was, in the 80s, was a complicated place. It's in California, but it has Southern roots. And in that Southern roots was some hardcore racism that still existed here in the Central Valley of California. And my mother was always worried about us because we had threats and we had a cross burn on the front lawn. They threw watermelons and pumpkins through our window and beer bottles with urine. We were having some real trouble for a long time, for almost a couple of years, from some racist group that was here in Bakersfield. And my mother was always worried about us when we were walking out the door, when we'd go wake up in the morning to do our paper out, and we would walk to school, and we were just going out to play. She was like, be careful, watch out for each other. So we had this kind of like secret task, no matter what happened, just be there to watch each other. There were cars that would drive by yelling names at us. And we felt like we were these, you know, two little black boys kind of traversing this world, feeling like we were in danger because, quite frankly, we were.
That sounds so scary.
It was terrifying. It was terrifying. But my mother was constantly in our face, reassuring us of our value and our beauty, of our kinky hair and our big noses and our skin. And at one point, I guess I was 11 years old, my mother gave up and we just moved away. And she felt defeated in a way by doing that. And we ended up moving back to a different house and into a different area. But Lloyd and I were like these, just, you know, we were watching out, looking out for each other.
And, you know, the good thing, as Gregory tells it, was that Lloyd had this sense of humor that was disarming and inviting. He genuinely cared about other people. It was like a superpower that he had, in spite of everything that he lived through.
He would actually, he'd do this my whole life. He would search for the person who was lonely or who might have had some affliction, whatever it be. Whatever the other is, he liked to bring that person into the mix and help them bring out the true person that they are. It's just what he did.
Do you think it's partly his talent of making someone feel like the most important person in the room?
Yep.
When you were in his orbit?
He did that. He did that. And he always amazed me how he would get to, like, very early in a friendship or in a relationship with somebody, he would get a lot of intimate information. And I always thought it was like, I was like, man, Lloyd, don't ask people that. People felt comfortable in talking to him about some really deep things. And because of that, they would become quite deep friends because they will have talked about some hidden thing. Funny thing is after he passed, there's a group of men, none of whom know each other really. I mean, but all of them called me and said, yeah, Lloyd was my best friend and I was his best friend. And at the moment, the count is about 18 people who think that they are Lloyd's best friend, and he is their best friend. So he had a lot of best friends. He made a lot of people feel like they were his best friend. And so that's a gift.
What a lovely testament to your life.
Completely.
So at what point did Lloyd realize he had COVID-19?
You know, around March, he started feeling some symptoms.
I was talking to him. I said, Lloyd, don't play with this. You know, if you think that by chance at all, it could be this COVID situation, go in and get checked out. And
So his wife dropped him off at the hospital and he went downhill fast.
They put him on regular oxygen that first day. And the next day they intubated him.
He got put on a ventilator. And the ventilator really became sort of like the point of no return for many people. Even once they got off of it, it became like this equator.
Yeah, just before that, it was just a few text messages, basically. You know, this is the best thing for me to do. And, you know, he said goodbye.
Is it right that he passed on your mother's birthday?
He did, just after 12 o'clock New York time on May 6th. He passed away. Yeah. And it feels so empty. I couldn't fly there and touch his hand. You know, it's just, it's heartbreaking that he's almost kidnapped by this disease and taken away. You know? You feel cheated. I mean, I still haven't hugged my brothers and sisters who are a 10-minute drive away. We haven't hugged each other. It's strange.
It's the strangest thing I've ever heard of. When you most need comfort, when you most need physical comfort, is the time that you cannot receive it.
It's cruel. It's cruel is what it is.
I've spoken with so many families experiencing these profound levels of grief. And it's made all the more intense because of social distancing rules. But I've also seen people come up with really unique ways of still somehow mourning together while following these rules. You know, in Lloyd's case, that community he'd worked so hard to build in Bed-Stuy was absolutely devastated.
We were just crying and feeling really sad and feeling like there was nothing we could do and saying, you know, we have to do something.
So Mandisa, Lloyd's friend, she and a couple of other neighbors thought, you know, we can't just sit in our houses. We need to show our support. We need to go and somehow deliver our love to Lloyd's wife, Hillary, and their young daughter somehow. So they sent out a message on text and then on social media, kind of to the whole neighborhood, like, hey, everyone, let's just go and walk by the Porter's house. Let's just show up and grieve with them at a distance.
Let me see if I can find the note for you and I can read it to you.
Okay.
It says, words cannot express how we all feel with the passing of our dear friend and neighbor, Lloyd Cornelius Porter. He has touched so many in ways that will stay with us forever.
And from that, it snowballed into this very well-orchestrated memorial procession.
Oh, wow.
Let's show them our love with a candlelight walk-by vigil. Bring your handmade signs, bow ties, shabby hats, flashlights, and all.
And Mandisa live-streamed it.
You guys want to show McElroy your signs?
You could hear her sort of making sure things were going the way that they should.
Whatever we're going to do, we need to start because we can't have people congregating together. It's going to cause a problem.
And everyone took a job from, you know, monitoring the corners to someone who made sure that people were walking by slowly enough but not taking too long.
Just walk by.
You know, they'd only get a few seconds in front of his family.
So as they were coming by, they would just stop in front of the Porter's house and kind of make the symbol of a hug, like your arms in an X, like hugging yourself. And Hillary and McLemore were outside returning the hugs. And it reminded them that this community loves them and supports them and is mourning with them.
We love you, Hill. We love you, Matt.
It was just such an elegant, heartbreaking procession.
How many people do you think showed up and walked by?
At least 100, she thought.
Wow.
You know, in only 30 minutes, I mean, the stream was so constant. This is one of the best instances of people coming together and improvising something that felt really special and intimate without breaking these rules.
All right, guys, we gotta go. Let's go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It strikes me listening to this, Kathleen, and meeting Lloyd through you, how many people have been lost in this way in such a short time. But I wonder about when you describe what happened with his family and friends. You know, I've sadly buried a lot of people, and it sounds almost more useful and more fulfilling than what we would normally do in terms of just have a funeral and speak words over the body and go to the graveside. All of that action of people walking in the community together. And this, it'll be different for everybody. Everybody needs different things. But I wonder, Kathleen, what you think about how all of this is going to actually change us and how we deal with death in the long term.
Well, I've spoken with a lot of people who've lost loved ones over the past few months, and many of them have said not being able to have what we might think of as a traditional funeral has kept them from having any real closure. But as someone who's covered death and funerals for a really long time, I can tell you the idea of closure from a funeral in one day or a week is misguided. And this pandemic has only brought that more in focus. It's going to take a lot of smaller intentional acts, both individually and gathering with others, either virtually or in a distance way, to get to the other side of being through the worst of your grieving. I mean, this is something that's never happened in our lifetime, this amount of people dying in such a short time. And so I think that maybe one of the bigger changes will be that death is less conceptual and more of a lived experience, that we let it come in a little closer and respond to it a little bit more authentically. And so maybe we'll be able to make our lives more meaningful as a result. You know, I was so wowed by all the things that people were sharing about Lloyd, all of the little details of his life, all of the ways that he affected these people that he came in contact with. His talents, his playfulness, his sweetness, his kindness. And during that walk by, Mandisa said that she imagined him jumping out from some hiding place saying, "You really do love me." And so it just made me think, like, is there a way to share these sentiments with each other before we die? Can we somehow snack at that buffet before we go? Can we know a little bit more about what we mean to each other?
Yes, it is the problem with grief and death in general, is we always want to know, did we snack at the buffet beforehand? And it's impossible to know.
We're always pushing forward, you know, and this time has allowed us to really consider how we can sort of step forward into what is valuable about our life. If it was snatched away, what will be remembered for?
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Reporting and producing in this episode by Vera Lynn Williams and Kathleen Horn, who is host and creator of Mortal City, a podcast available on Audible. The episode was edited by Christopher Wirth and Karen Frohman, who is also our executive producer. It was mixed by Jared Paul. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Jenny Casas, and Marianne McCune, with help this week from Kim Nowacki. And a special thanks to Letitia Theodore Green, Amy Cunningham, and the Porter family. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Atterboro Brass Band. Keep in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And as always, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.